live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Have a lot to share. Going to talk about what job stress does to our health. Also, the role of vitamin C in the heart. Zinc on diabetes. What estrogen does that could cause you to die real quick, and who is most likely to have an elevated estrogen level. Also going to talk about, I care about nature, but, interesting comment here from Research News, and 1.3 million wrongly treated after false positive from mammograms. Those are just some of the issues that I'm selecting to empower people so that the bad news that we report helps you understand why you have to really do your homework before you accept just any test or any vaccine or anything in a medical procedure. From our environmental segment today, we'll be looking at solar flares. Did you forget about them? You shouldn't. Solar flares were coming out over the weekend. And according to space.com, quote, the sun has unleashed two colossal flares since Sunday night, firing off its most powerful eruptions of the year in less than one day. What does that mean? I'll talk about that. The price of our fertilizer addiction, toxic waste on par with malaria as a global killer. Now, that's hard to imagine, but it's true. When you look at how many children died last year from the effects of living in a toxic environment, it was 800,000. How many died from malaria? 725,000 just last year. That meant that the toxins in our environment killed more people than malaria, more kids. And then expose Monsanto's chemical war against indigenous Hawaiians. We'll share that with you. And then commentary of the day is from David Swanson from Countercurrents. Why we allow the destruction of our planet. My guest on today's program is Dr. Guy McPherson. He is Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources, Ecology, and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. His specialization, forest resources, energy decline, and climate change and their economic consequences. We'll be asking him, what are the changes of humanity seriously tackling in order to help slow down or reverse climate change? And he'll be sharing with us something you won't hear from most anyone else, the dire consequences of our failures to do so, and how do we deal with dire predictions of our future. It'll be an unsettling interview, but one that's necessary because he's one of the very few people smart enough to know the truth and honest enough to speak it. As you can see, we have a lot to cover. If time permits, I intend to take on the idea that most doctors are noble and honest and dedicated and caring. That was the comment from my two guests last night when we were challenging the legitimacy of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry number 5 coming out, which in effect pathologizes everything. Every behavior is pathologized. And both people supported fully the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual as a legitimate diagnosing book. And both supported medicine completely, that you might occasionally find, you know, a doctor that doesn't have the best of motives, but the vast, vast, vast majority certainly do. Really? Well, I'll offer a challenge and the scholarship to support it on today's program. Let's begin. Job stress and unhealthy lifestyle increases the risk of coronary artery disease compared with stress and a healthy lifestyle. This is interesting. This is from the Canadian Medical Association Journal. It says people with job stress and an unhealthy lifestyle are at a bigger disadvantage and a higher risk of coronary artery disease than people who have job stress but lead healthy lifestyles. To determine whether a healthy lifestyle can help reduce the effects of job stress on coronary artery disease, researchers looked at 7 important studies from a large European initiative that looked at over 102,000 individuals. They looked at multiple diseases over a 15-year period, and the people average age was 44. And this was in the United Kingdom, France, Belgium, Sweden, and Finland. 52% were women. So this is a big study. And here's what they found. They found that if you are stressed at work and you have an unhealthy lifestyle, you have a much greater risk. In fact, it was almost 400% more likely to have a heart attack or coronary artery disease. Whereas if you were stressed and were healthy, it was substantially less. So one more reason why, even if we can't always change the circumstances in our life, and we can't, some things we cannot alter, we can certainly stay as healthy as possible. It will put an advantage on our side. Vitamin C is very important for a lot of reasons. There are over 30,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on vitamin C. This is from Denmark. And they ask a question, does vitamin C deficiency increase lifestyle-associated vascular disease progression? Evidence based upon experimental clinical studies. That's the title of the article. And this is from Copenhagen's University in Denmark, and it says, in a review of studies investigating the effects of vitamin C on vascular function and control, including nitric oxide, bioavailability, lipid metabolism, and vascular integrity, a large body of evidence exists to support the relationship between poor vitamin C status and increased risk of developing cardiovascular disease, and which is 20% of the Western population is found to have vitamin C deficiency, which would be very easily resolved with supplementation. The authors state that additional research, quote, increased insight into vitamin C deficiency mediated cardiovascular disease progression will enable the design of fully randomized controlled trials. What this is saying, they're giving you a half-truth without acknowledging the other half. So they're saying if you're deficient in vitamin C, you really increase your risk of having heart disease. Well, why not simply use the other half? If you have plenty of vitamin C, you are preventing heart disease by a substantial measure. And I suggest that you have vitamin C when you get up in the morning, immediately following your exercise. If you're under stress or in a polluted environment, or especially if you're flying, then you should have vitamin C about every 2 hours, 1,000 milligrams, when you're in the air. That helps thin the blood, oxygenate the cells, and helps prevent thrombosis or blood clotting, which is common because of the cabin pressure and because of the legs and circulation not being what it should be when you're sitting for a long period of time. So I would take vitamin C when I get off a plane. I would take vitamin C, lots of vitamin C, intravenous vitamin C after an X-ray, and any trauma, vitamin C also helps. So there's a lot of good that vitamin C does. It also helps keep your skin younger and tighter. Zinc is also important, and this comes from the University of Sydney in Australia, and it says the following. Inflammation markers predict zinc transporter gene expression in women with type 2 diabetes mellitus. That's the title of the article, published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Nutritional Biochemistry. Now, this was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled 12-week study involving postmenopausal women. And what would 40 milligrams, that's a relatively small amount, 40 milligrams of zinc, as well as 2 grams of flaxseed oil, have on inflammatory markers in the body? Remember, inflammation is a part of cancer, arthritis, diabetes, and heart disease. But they were only measuring it in relationship to diabetes. And they found that, quote, associations among inflammatory cytokines and zinc transporter gene expression support an interrelationship between zinc homeostasis and inflammation, meaning, in type 2 diabetes, meaning if you have zinc each day in your diet, it helps prevent the inflammation from type 2 diabetes, which then helps prevent dementia and arthritis. So there's a cascade once you turn off inflammation, and this does. And an important article, you almost never hear this discussed, and this is a big article because it involved a lot of people in the research, and it says the finding of following. Estrogen levels tied to risk of sudden cardiac death, quote, tests reveal higher concentrations of the sex hormone in women and men. Higher levels of the hormone estrogen are associated with an increased risk of sudden cardiac death in men and women. Now, how bad is it? Well, here's the reality. Sudden cardiac death can occur when the heart suddenly and unexpectedly stops beating. That's called sudden cardiac arrest. Last year, at least 350,000 people in the United States died from sudden cardiac death. Now, researchers examined data from people in Portland, Oregon, who suffered sudden cardiac death or had coronary artery disease. And what they found was that they were generally overweight, high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol. And, of course, the levels of testosterone were much lower among men and slightly higher among women in the sudden cardiac death group. But the estrogen level here was much higher, and the testosterone-estrogen ratio was lower in both men and women who suffered from sudden cardiac death. Now, here, from my experience, are three reasons why you should not want elevated, out-of-balance estrogen in men or women. Not only does it cause heart disease and heart attacks, but when you're overweight, you increase your estrogen level. So everyone is susceptible to increased risk of heart attacks because of increased risk of estrogen going up when you're overweight. Secondly, when you're under stress, the stress hormones create extra estrogen. So now you've got a second thing working against you. And then when you're consuming the average high-protein, meat-based American diet, that also drives up estrogen. Meat drives estrogen. All right? Each one of those puts you at risk of a heart attack. But what about all three? How many people are overweight and eat a high-protein diet and are stressed because they are overweight or stressed for some other reason? You have all three. You have the trifecta. Bad thing to have. And that's why when people are overweight and stressed and on high-protein diets, you're at a far greater risk of having a heart attack and dying. Now at least we have studies showing the association and the exact interconnectivity here. That's why I put everyone on a vegan program, a de-stress program, and a exercise program to detoxify and lose weight. And then you start looking at the blood chemistry about every 3 months, and you'll see the homocysteine, C-reactive protein, blood pressure, pulse rate, all coming down, cholesterol, HDL to LDL ratios coming into normal range and turning off inflammation. So that's why you got to have your blood chemistry checked. Now, exercise can ease the pain of fibromyalgia, according to a new study. This is from Wake Forest Medical Center, and it says, exercise won't exacerbate the pain associated with fibromyalgia. It may actually improve it. And this was a Important study that found that light to moderate physical activity over time could ease the symptoms of fibromyalgia. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Arthritis Care and Research. So, a lot of people stop exercising when they have fibromyalgia. This is showing that you should actually increase. And finally, from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, research from the National Cancer Institute and University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, the greater the fiber intake, the lower the risk of kidney cancer. There were 491,000 participants in the National Institutes of Health's AARP diet and health study for men and women between 50 and 71. And what they found was that when you had the right kind of fiber and the right amount of fiber, you didn't have the same association with kidney cancer. I'm suggesting between 30 at the low end and 50 at the high end grams of fiber a day. On to, you know, those people, the ones who say, I care about nature. I remember, I see this all the time. People who say they care about something, but they're not doing a thing about it. This is from Research News. I'll quote it. Many entrepreneurs claim that they care about sustainability, yet they make decisions that are harmful to the environment. Economic researchers from Germany and the USA have discovered that many bosses do indeed have firm convictions when it comes to the environment, but they then unconsciously disengage their values from their business actions. The type of entrepreneur most likely to fall into this category are those who perceive themselves as highly influential or operating in a challenging industry. The researchers' findings have shed new light on the significance of moral values and the subconscious in the context of making business decisions. The study could influence environmental legislation and the training of the next generation of entrepreneurs. I would offer a different perspective on this. It's not about having a value for the environment or people who suffer, but rather, do you have the courage and are you willing to make some sacrifices in order to self-actualize that? Now think of all the men and women who not only control corporations that are major polluters, but also their products or services adversely affect the lives of people all over the world, if not here. Think of the fire in Bangladesh. That fire would not have happened had there not been a demand for 900 million garments last year, and the women were paid 14 cents an hour. So there was enormous profit to be made by manufacturing there. The government was fully complicit. There is an entire corruption system that they'll allow you, if you give them money, to build anything and then to exploit the workers working in those conditions. I mean, for example, what they didn't tell you about factories in Bangladesh is what I will. Imagine that it's midnight and you're walking down a street and it's quiet. If you were to close your eyes, you would barely hear a thing. But if there were bright street lights, which there are not, you would see the entire street taken up with people, women, hundreds of thousands of women walking. They're walking because they cannot afford a bus or a train or a cab. They're going home. When they get home, they have to prepare food for the next day for their family. They have to wash their clothes. They have to clean up the house, and then they'll get maybe 3, maybe 4 hours of sleep. They get up, they have their breakfast, they dress their kids, and they go back to work. They walk back to work. Once at work, there is a foreman, and these foremen frequently have stopwatches. And if you're putting in a zipper, there's so many seconds it takes to do this, or a button, or sewing a seam, and you're allowed 2 bathroom breaks a day. That's it. Women are frequently verbally abused and also with a switch hit. They don't like talking. You can't bring cell phones. you're allowed a short break for a meal. The water's generally polluted, and so diarrhea is chronic, and it's very regimented. And many of the women just sleep at their desk when it's time to stop. And then they exit and another crew comes on. And the average work life of a person in the women's factories is 32. I repeat, 32. Why isn't this story told? Why is it the American media only talks about, are there any victims left? How many died? Body counts. But the human story and the suffering are completely avoided. Now, I'm not the only person to discover the facts of what goes on in Bangladesh. I've been talking about buying American or fair trade garments for a long time. But that would mean that we would then have to hold those brand names in the major department stores accountable. And we won't do that. We won't open up that door, because it'll make so many Americans look bad, from the manufacturers and the people that exported, closed down the factories down in the garment industry and outsourced those jobs to Bangladesh or China or wherever. So there are truths that we will not ask. We just can't handle it. So what if you had the courage just to say, we should pride ourselves in not only the product we make and the service we provide, but the conditions in which the people who work with us are able to be rewarded and acknowledged. And look what we do for the environment. Now, we may make less overall profit, but at least the money we make is not indenturing anyone. It's not exploiting people. Rare, not impossible, but rare is that the case. I believe that one of the largest resources in the United States are the millions of retired top-level executive policymakers in the thousands of gated communities. Now, of course, people know the more famous ones, Naples, Florida, West Palm Beach, Palm Springs, Sedona. They don't look at the thousands of other gated communities where you have a lot of retired executives. The phones don't ring. These people have not lost their mental faculties. They still are impassioned, but now they can actually make ethical decisions and provide guidance and insight. They could help a lot of causes, help a lot of people. And I know that many of them would love that opportunity. So I believe that we should start, those of us who are in social movements, should reach out to these individuals for their guidance and their help. Especially now, they wouldn't be interested and have to risk everything and fear that, you know, if they did the right thing, the moral thing, that it would cost them their job, because they don't have to be anywhere the rest of their life. Therefore, maybe for the first time in their adult life, they could live at a higher ethical level. So it's something to consider. And that way we don't have to hear people say, I care about nature, but I can't actualize it. Yeah, you can. I'll close out today's health segment with this. From the New England Journal of Medicine, from Lance Devon, Natural News, the Susan Komen for Breast Cancer Awareness reports on their site that breast cancer will strike more than 1.3 million women annually over the next 20 years. They are proud to report that 70% of women 40 and over receive regular mammograms now. What they aren't telling the public is that their pharmaceutical and radiation-funded awareness project is giving millions of women false diagnosis by the very mammogram technology they promote. As a matter of fact, the New England Journal of Medicine has identified approximately 1.3 million cases of misdiagnosed breast cancer, concluding that mammograms are leading millions of women to astray, making them believe that they have cancer when they really don't. This means that highly entrusted mammograms are manifesting millions of fake cancers, sending millions of unsuspecting women through further unneeded tests, procedures, medications, and radiation. So where's the breast cancer awareness money going? Instead of ending breast cancer forever, as the Susan G. Komen cause claims, they are actually funding perpetual mammogram testing and subsequent medication and radiation that is only feeding the medical industry and the cancer itself. The Komen race for the cure alone has raised $2 billion. Where is this money going? It's definitely not going to find a cure, but rather fooling millions of women into believing they have cancer when they really don't. It's all very much a corporate scam. The Susan B. Komen Awareness is really a company with a long list of high-paid employees, marketers, and executives who do nothing but promote a color and a title. 39.1% of their $390 million worth of assets goes towards public health education, which obviously doesn't point anyone towards proper nutrition utilization, but instead teaches women to get their routine screening and swallow their pill. The money they raise practically goes straight to buying the very mammogram testing machines that are perpetuating the problem. According to The Cause, the single most effective screening tool to fight breast cancer is, in fact, the holy mammogram. The rest of their money goes right into fundraising and radio ads to promote their deceptive processes. Most mammograms detect cancer at stage zero. This non-invasive cancer, left untreated, does not progress, does not cause further harm, and does not become invasive. It regresses without medication, without radiation. Sadly, though, millions of women are being put through the system, unintentionally lied to, even as evidence suggests that all these stage zero breast cancer detections are misleading. The whole screening system is just bloating statistics of breast cancer in the United States and ramming new patients through the system. The Komen Cause proudly reveals that the largest group of cancer survivors in the U.S. is breast cancer survivors, 3 million. This fact is only true because most breast cancer survivors survived cancer that was non-invasive or was regressive in the first place. In fact, according to the journal Lancet Oncology, a cohort study verified that even most, quote, invasive, end quote, cancers appear to regress with time if left untreated. The scientific study also points out that, quote, the introduction of screening mammography in the United States has been associated with a doubling in the number of cases of early-stage breast cancer that are detected each year. They noted, quote, only 6.5% of these early-stage breast cancer cases were expected to progress to advanced disease. That's 94.5% or 93.5% would not. Here's the even bigger con. Mammograms put off low-energy x-rays, which is 300% more carcinogenic than high-energy radiation that comes from the atomic bomb blast. This fact goes unnoticed because today's radiation risk models were developed before DNA was even discovered. What scientists should be developing is real scanning technology that goes after the mammogram itself, exposing its low-energy radiation effects on human cells. When DNA is exposed to low-energy radiation put off by the mammograms, the genes that are susceptible to breast cancer, the BRCA1 and BRCA2, actually interfere with the body's self-repairing DNA mechanism. As the body tries to reduce the carcinogens that are welcomed in by the radiation, it becomes more susceptible to developing cancer. Now, the medical community must understand that x-ray-based mammography is not preventing, but actually enabling, future breast cancer by torturing the DNA. Women everywhere shouldn't feel obligated to submit to radiation mammograms that are misdiagnosing and actually causing cancer. The Susan B. Komen Breast Cancer Awareness needs to tell women the truth. The pink parade is over. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Your past. I just want a love to last. I don't care, darling,
have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. And we do have a lot of people listening and sharing the information. For all of you who do tune in each day, or most people, 99% of the people who listen to this program listen to it in the evenings by downloading the program. You can listen from many different sources, including TuneIn.com, Stitcher.com, iTunes.com. These are some of the sources. Plus, you can actually just listen over the telephone, as a whole lot of people do each and every day. And it's that number anywhere you want in North America and Canada, 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869. It's not enough to point out that our political system is completely corrupted by money, including money from coal and oil and nuclear industry and gas. Of course it is. And according to David Swanson, if we had direct democracy, polls suggest we would be investing in green energy. But saying the right thing to a pollster on a phone or in a focus group is hardly the extent of what one ought sensibly to do when the fate of the world is at stake. Nor do we get a complete explanation by recognizing that our communication system is in bed with our political system, cooperatively pushing lies about our climate and our budget. For example, you never hear we talking about defunding the wars. No. Of course, when the planet's climate is being destroyed for all future generations, most of which will therefore not exist, the only sensible course of action is to drop everything and nonviolently challenge the system for its corruption, because the system is carrying out the destruction. So why don't we? Well, one reason is misinformation. It's a surface-level explanation. Why do people choose to accept obvious misinformation? Here's just one reason. They've already chosen to accept other obvious misinformation to which they are deeply and passionately attached, and which requires this additional self-deception. The beliefs involved correlate with poor education, so government choices to fund fossil fuels and highways to nowhere and prisons and the president of Afghanistan, remember, the CIA is dropping off shopping bags of millions of dollars on a regular basis. But they're doing that, and they're not funding our schools. They're not funding the poor. But perhaps we should confront the misinformation directly, even while pursuing the creation of an educational system worthy of a civilized country. According to a Newsweek poll, 40% of the people in the United States believe the world will end with a battle between Jesus Christ and the Antichrist. And overwhelmingly, those who believe that also believe that natural disaster and violence are signs of the approach of the glorious battle. So much so that 22% in the United States believe the world will end in their lifetime. This would logically mean that concern for the world of their great-great-great-grandchildren make no sense at all and should be dismissed from their minds. In fact, a recent study found that belief in the second coming reduces support for strong governmental action on climate change. Apart from the corruption of money, whenever you have 40% of all Americans believing something that stupid, the forces of gerrymandering in the House, disproportionate representation of small states in the Senate, the Senate filibuster, the winner-take-all two-party system that shuts all reasonable, independent, and progressive voices out of the media and debates and ballots while allowing the corporate Democrats to get elected purely on the qualification of not being Republicans, and a communications system that mainstreams Republican beliefs almost guarantees that the 40% view will control the government. Congressman John Shimkus, a Republican from a gerrymandered monstrosity in southeastern Illinois, says the planet is in fine shape and guaranteed to stay that way because God promised that to Noah. Senator James Inhofe, a Republican from Oklahoma, a state whose citizens get 10 times the representation in the Senate that Californians do, if one can accuse Dianne Feinstein of representing anyone but herself, says that only God could possibly change the climate, and we should stop being so arrogant, as if taking $1.4 million in campaign contributions from fossil fuel profiteers and imagining that your positions are purely determined by your access to an all-powerful being who runs the universe on behalf of the 30% of the world that world raised on the same fairy tales as you isn't an arrogant belief. Another senator who claims to be a theist, but not of the Shimkus variety, publicly denounced an unnamed colleague this week for pushing the "Don't worry, God is on the job" line in a recent meeting. When large portions of the population believe that catastrophe is a good thing rather than a bad thing, and wars are celebrated, and crises bring excitement and solidarity to our lives, the influence is toxic. Of the 40% who believe Jesus is on his way, some no doubt believe it more than others, allow it to shape more of their other beliefs and actions. Of the other 60%, some are no doubt influenced to varying degrees by the Armageddonists. Belief in theism itself reaches as much as 80% of the U.S. and includes strong activists for sustainable policies, including some who passionately proselytize using the argument that only theism can save us from our apathy in the face of global warming. And there is no question that our most dedicated peace and justice activists include some strong religious believers, but theism is essentially the belief that some more powerful being running the show, perhaps the Armageddonists, haven't really found a solution to the problem of evil, said a prisoner in a Nazi camp, but the non-Armageddonist theists have never found a logical solution to the problem of free will either. Theists can go either way and may all make as little sense as each other, but they must all of necessity promote the notion that a more powerful being is in charge, so they don't have to be. And where does that belief show up in the damaging effects? In our politics, it shows up primarily as an attitude toward presidents. When President Obama has spent 5 years working diligently to destroy our national environment for all time to come, the largest block of those concerned about global warming have spent their time telling each other to trust in him. Bill McKibben, you know him? Trust Obama. Sorry, Bill. Can't do that. That he works in mysterious ways. Does he? In secret, yes. But that's not mysterious. That he is up against the evil one and must be allowed time to succeed in his battle. You see, the problem with this is not that some of its spin-off beliefs succeed in the undemocratic system we have. The problem is that this entire group are anti-democratic to their core. This moves us away from relying upon ourselves. It teaches us to rely on someone supposedly better than we. And the same 80% or so also believe in something called heaven, which renders real life far less significant even for those generations that get to experience it. This in turn fuels a belief in optimism. We are all told to be optimists regardless of the facts, as if it were a personal lifestyle choice. Combine that with a belief that everything is part of a secret master plan, and you've got a recipe for submissive acceptance. I've had great activists tell me that everything will work out for the best, either because that keeps them going or because they've learned to say anything else earns them fewer speaking invitations. Hardcore optimism is compatible with active engagement, but the net effect is almost always certainly a contribution to apathy. I wish it were needless to say that I am not advocating the equally dumb position of willful pessimism. I'm proposing the unpopular position of taking the facts that, as they come, acting accordingly and acting cautiously when it comes to the fate of generations of yet unborn, even if that caution required huge sacrifices. There are other powerful forces weighing against action as well. There is our love of technology, including our fantasies about inventing our way out of every catastrophe, colonizing other planets, creating better species of human beings. Oh, yes, they're looking at the gene that will create a better mind, a better body, better vision, better attitude, more compliant. Maybe our senator friend is onto something after all when he points to arrogance. There's also greed, including our fear that living sustainably would involve living with less of the materialistic stuff that currently clutters our lives and fuels our obesity. There's also the con job continuously played on us by our government that persuades so many of us, including the good Democrat, that we are powerless to effect change, except support your leader. It's not enough to believe that the world is being destroyed and that we humans are on our own with the plants and other animals. If we've fallen for the biggest scam governments can pull on their people, the lie that says, pay no attention to us. History teaches us the opposite. People's influence on their governments is much more powerful than we usually imagine. It's weakened primarily by people's failure to do anything. Impotence is a self-fulfilling loop. Those longing for the end of the world are far from alone in imagining that we don't have the power to make the world over ourselves. Nonetheless, among the things we should be doing right now is explaining to our neighbors that this isn't a dress rehearsal. We can do something constructive. I just don't see that our government, our politicians, the major corporations, the major celebrities, all of the news media, most foundations, including those on the left, are going to do a damn thing about anything except maintain the illusion that they are all-seeing, all-knowing, all-powerful, and we should rely upon them. Back in a moment with my guests. Please stay with us.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread.
I'd like to welcome all of you. My guest is on board now, Dr. Guy McPherson. I talked about him earlier, Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources, Ecology, and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. And he is the author of an important memoir, Walking Away from Empire. And his website is guymcpherson.com. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back, Gary. I appreciate it.
I'd like to begin first with you speaking about the increase in the number of climate change and environmental scientists who are now becoming more alarmed at the dire prospects of the future sustaining human life on Earth as we know it today. And quite a number of scientists now, Doctors Clive Hamilton, James Hansen, Frank Finner, among them, that humans could be facing extinction within the next 100 years. At best, and putting the predictions aside, the case is being made that current climate trends, in league with the lack of political and economic will to make fundamental changes, will at some point contribute to the Earth being uninhabitable for humans. So those are such extreme discussions that no one's willing to have them. It's as if we don't want to scare people with the truth, so therefore we continue to allow people to believe that all these extensive weather patterns can be tolerated. Your thoughts, please.
Well, there certainly are an increasing number of scientists coming on board with the idea that we have triggered self-reinforcing feedback loops that can and will lead to our extinction. Even James Hansen has been saying for many years that if we mine the tar sands, that's game over for the climate. Well, guess what? We're mining the tar sands. So sounds to me like it's game over for the climate. He's been pretty conservative in his approach from the beginning. There are several other climate scientists, Wasdell and notably Paul Beckwith, who have been pointing out the dire straits we're in for quite a bit longer than James Hansen. But James Hansen was an early voice pointing out nearly 30 years ago that if we don't completely turn the ship around, there are going to be dire consequences. Well, there are dire consequences. They've kicked into play already.
Would you briefly share your personal story of being a tenured, secure professor at an excellent university with the freedom to pursue your research and passions in studying and teaching the environment and climate science, and then basically dropped everything to embrace a completely different lifestyle? And since you called your book Walking Away from Empire, go into more deeply into what that should mean for all of us now. And most of us are fully immersed in empire, even if we rebel against it. Nevertheless, we are still players in the system, and I talk about this constantly, where we act hypocritical. We'll say we believe in something, and then our lifestyle and actions show we're doing just the opposite.
Yeah, well, and, you know, although my latest book is titled Walking Away from Empire, it would be easy to argue that I haven't. I mean, I'm talking with you on the telephone, going out over the Internet. At the same time, I'm logged into Facebook and Gmail and so on, and I developed a relatively durable set of living arrangements here on this rock pile in the desert only because I was able to take advantage of having lived an imperial life for long enough that I had fiat currency that I could spend on this durable set of living arrangements, including a well-insulated straw bale house, for example. But to answer the question, I was a tenured full professor at a major research university, and for many years I'd been pointing out the dark underbelly of industrial civilization, that what it takes to maintain an empire in decline is obedience at home, oppression abroad, and full-scale destruction of the living planet on which we depend for our lives. And that's all fine to teach that and point that out, and the examples are legion and growing at this point. But you can't do that indefinitely, point out the dark underbelly of industrial civilization and continue to live at the apex of empire, continue to pick the low-hanging fruit of empire while pointing out that there's something wrong with that. And so at some point after pointing out the absurdity for several years, I decided not to do that anymore. So now I live on a shared property with my wife, another couple, and their young son, and we use solar power to get the water out of the ground, as well as a hand pump. We grow a tremendous proportion of the food we eat, and to the maximum extent possible, I live outside of empire now. I'm still at the edge of empire, I would say, but trying to move further away with every day.
Good for you. I commend that. Why is it so difficult for people to handle the truth about climate change and environmental destruction and the dark side of our entire civilization and the dark side of the sociopathic leaders at its helm? And I'm including 98% of all leaders as being sociopathic in their actions.
I think you're exceedingly generous. I don't know where you're coming up with 2%.
I can't be 100% certain about anything.
Well, it's, you know, for years I was pointing out that industrial civilization was hovering on the brink and fortunately would collapse in time to allow our species to persist a few more generations, because we hadn't kicked into play those self-reinforcing feedback mechanisms on the climate front that are sure to cause our extinction. And that was a tough enough sell, telling people that our way of life is about to change, that you can't go to the grocery store 24/7 and get anything you want, that you can't flip a switch and have lights come on, that you can't turn on the tap and have water come out of the tap. You know, that's a dire enough message. And then you go one step further and realize, as I did last June, that it's too late, that we've triggered so many self-reinforcing feedback mechanisms that we surely guaranteed extinction in our own hand. People don't really like hearing that. I don't really like saying it. You know, nobody wants to face their own mortality, much less the mortality of our entire species. So I understand why that's a tough thing to absorb. It's difficult enough for me, and I've had a good run. And I'm a conservation biologist, so I've known for a long time that birth is lethal at the level of individuals as well as at the level of species. So I can understand why there's incredible resistance to the kinds of things I speak about and write about. Truth is tough.
Well, let's follow up on that. How do you deal with such dire news, since we cannot expect the politicians, banks, large corporations, the media to do anything realistically constructive to ward off the dangers? And yet there are those millions of us, independent and progressive thinking people, who want a sustainable environment and are relocating to places that at least give us an opportunity, growing our own food organically, getting natural water sources, staying out of highly dense population areas, keeping away from the ocean. Look, a year and a half ago, I'm running up the beach in South Beach. I do a 10-mile run. And I suddenly saw for the first time, I saw seaweed on the bottom of a swimming pool, an outdoor swimming pool. Now, I ran that a lot of times, and I never saw that. That meant that the high tide was coming in at a higher level, which to me said, okay, this feedback loop is in process. Greater melt in Antarctica, in Greenland, in glaciers, a warming water, expanding of the water, and now it was up there. And I'm saying, if this continues at this pace in another 5 years, all of these buildings, tens of thousands of buildings built up and down the east coast of the United States at this close to the water, are going to have their underground support system pulled out, and the buildings made unsafe or not habitable because they're all resting on sand, not stone. And then after Sandy, there was just right up from there in Fort Lauderdale, there was a big beach, big beach, gone. All the palm trees behind the beach, gone. Parking lot behind that, gone. Sidewalk on before the road, gone. And the road, the main road, gone. And here are all these people looking out of their windows and coming downstairs and saying, it's over. For them, it is over. I sold my property and got out because I didn't want to be the last person. I was thinking, well, gee whiz, surely this is happening. This is happening, and it's happening everywhere. So that taken into consideration, there are a lot of us who are doing a lot of efforts to pull off the grid, take our money out of their banks, not shop in their stores, not vote for their politicians, be conscious in the choices we're making. So how do you address the two groups, those who can't deal with dire news and those who can?
Well, I certainly encourage and practice resistance against the dominant paradigm, including all those things you mentioned, taking the money out of the banks and not shopping at the stores, and all those kinds of acts that are in this day and age countercultural. But I recognize that Upton Sinclair had it right nearly 100 years ago. It's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it. And there's a lot of people, including most of my colleagues in the climate sciences, whose salary depends upon them not understanding it. And so cognitive dissonance carries the day, it seems to me. It's tough enough to deal with our own individual mortality, so as individuals and ultimately as societies, we come up with stories that claim mortality is not real. So we come up with religion, we come up with reincarnation, we come up with these notions that have no evidentiary support, that it'll all be fine. And so it's one step from there, it seems to me, to it'll all be fine on every level, not just the level of personal mortality, but the set of living arrangements and everything else that goes along with us not understanding reality.
Final question. The last time we spoke, you gave us your prediction of what you saw would be the beginning of the end if people did not make radical change. If we did, you saw things so bad and tipping that some could not be undone. And by the way, since then, we have reached out to every major climatologist we could, and we simply said, be honest. Of these 12 tipping points, how many have tipped, how many are going to tip and cannot be reversed, and how many can we prevent? And believe it or not, they almost all agreed with you. And that is frightening. Tell us your prediction.
Well, I think that's right. It's hard to deny the scientific evidence for those feedbacks that have been triggered. Almost all of them have been reported in high-ranking refereed journals. This isn't my prediction, but this is a well-supported prediction from other people. So on a planet four degrees centigrade hotter than baseline, which is 1850.
Which we have now.
So currently we have about 1 degree above baseline.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, yes. I was thinking 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide.
Well, and that brings up a good point. In the human experience, we've never witnessed 400 parts per million CO2 till now. We've never witnessed an ice-free Arctic, and we're going to see that within the next, at most, 3 years. So the take-home is, on a planet 4 degrees C hotter than baseline, all we can prepare for is human extinction. That's from Oliver Tickell's 2008 synthesis in The Guardian. That goes back 5 years now. According to an informed assessment of BP's Energy Outlook 2030, which came out in January of this year, global average temperature of Earth will hit the 4 degrees centigrade mark in 2030. If all we can prepare for is human extinction at 4C, and we're headed for 4C in 2030, that indicates to me that we're headed for relatively near-term human extinction.
In 15 to 17 years.
Yeah, 2030 is 17 years down the road.
17 years, but you don't suddenly hit a point and have extermination. It builds up.
That's right, and so I suspect in the northern hemisphere, the changes will come more quickly because there's so much more land-to-water ratio here in the northern hemisphere compared to the southern hemisphere.
Okay, well, for those of us who know and suspect the truth, we're working on it. I'm working on it. A lot of people are. For those who are not, I hope they wake up and get the message. Dr. Guy McPherson, thank you very much for sharing this sobering honesty with us.
Thank you, Gary. I appreciate it. If folks could go to my website, guymcpherson.com, you can find a link right at the top of the page to the documentary film Mike Sozomby just produced. And I would encourage you to take a look at that, see if it might be worth viewing with yourself.
We have a brand new program on documentary starting in 3 weeks. I'll have the producer contact him, see about having him on.
That'd be excellent. Thanks.
All the best to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources, Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, University of Arizona. Quite simply, one of the most brilliant men walking the planet. And you heard what he had to say. Thank you very much for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. We're out of time, so I don't want to run Utrice Lise. Let's say hello to Utrice Lise, so she has her full program. Hi, Utrice.
Hello. Good afternoon, Gary. Today, of course, we're following up on yesterday's program. Some prophetic things have been happening, mostly. New scandals are unfolding by the minute, so we're going to talk about those and the options that Barack Obama has.
Excellent. We look forward to hearing from it. Utrice Lise, coming right now.